Has the war started?
Sir, you... you should have made your presence known.
In the middle of that beautiful love scene? That wouldn't have been very tactful, would it? But don't worry. Your secret is safe with me.
Sir, you are no gentleman.
And you, miss, are no lady.
Oh.
But don't think that I hold that against you. Ladies have never held any charm for me.
First you take a low, common advantage of me, then you insult me.
I meant it as a compliment. And I hope to see more of you when you're free of the spell of the elegant Mr. Wilkes. He doesn't strike me as half good enough for a girl of your... what was it? Your passion for living?
How dare you? You aren't fit to wipe his boot.
And you were going to hate him for the rest of your life.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Awards Don't Matter, the podcast that takes a look at all the best picture winners in history and time and eternity, and which is very appropriate for this particular film, says, do they still matter or not? I am Andrew Pearce, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dave. Welcome, Dave.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, see, I knew this was going to happen, Andrew. I've commented more than once about how you can tell when Andrew's in a good mood, when he's because you get a good day at the very beginning. We just get a hello. It's hello. It's time to talk about Gone with the Wind. It's time for your homework.
So... yeah, homework. Homework. That's the spirit. That's it. Sometimes there are films, like there are films that we do episodes on, which, you know, we're reaching almost 20 episodes of this thing, and this is the 12th Best Picture winner, and sometimes there are films where I'm like, I can't wait to talk about this film because it's going to be so interesting. And sometimes there are films where I'm like, I can't wait to not talk about this film and try and skirt around it as much as possible. So what we're going to do to avoid actually discussing Gone with the Wind to start off with is we're going to talk about the Best Picture winners, nominees in this lineup here, first of all. Because for this year, 1939, pretty good year. Pretty good year.
Oh, my God. Pretty good. Andrew, way to undersell it. This is, I mean, this is not only the best crop of nominees so far. I mean, we'll see as we move forward, but this may be the best ever. Like, there are legitimately at least three or four movies on here that are, like, five-star movies.
Oh, yeah.
Like, great. Great, great films. And that's so, and that's like half the nominees, and the rest of them are all good to pretty good.
Yeah.
There's not, I don't think there's a bad movie in this bunch, and I watched all of them. So like
tell us,
an idiot.
Tell us about them then. Tell us about them, because I watched a fair bunch of them too, and so I can jump in, and we're going to do an extra episode on one of the nominees as well. So yeah, tell us about what you watched from, the list.
All right. So, you know, you've got Dark Victory, which is a Bette Davis movie, also with Humphrey Bogart. It's just like it's a melodrama, you know. It's a little over the top, like playing a hedonistic socialite and heiress. Like, so it's fun. It's a fun movie. And I think I'd actually watched this for, you know, one of those podcasts I do with Mike Dennison. I can't, honest to God, cannot remember which one it was because there are so many different ones. So that's really good. Goodbye, Mr. Chips is okay. It's fine. It's, to me, it's kind of disposable. It's about a teacher kind of looking back on his life. Like, we've seen this type of movie before. There's nothing bad about it, but there's also nothing particularly memorable about it. It's like, it's a nice story about a nice man, you know, and that's fine, but that's not going to be something that you write home about. Right. That's not going to be something that's memorable. Love Affair, directed by Leo McCarey. Another kind of like romance slash comedy.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah. Irene Dunne. Like it's a really solid movie. Like that feels like a perfect like 3 to 3.5 star movie. Like, yeah, that it's as described. I had a good time. It's not a movie I feel like I'm going to go back to and watch over and over and over again. But like, if somebody was like, oh, I want to watch Love Affair, be totally fine with that. Yeah.
I actually think it's a really worthwhile film for people to seek out simply because of the Sleepless in Seattle connection where you know, it's so obvious, you know, when the third act of that film comes around and then, all these machinations come in place and it's like, oh, right. I understand where they got that from. And it's nice and charming. Yeah, it's
good. Yes, exactly. That's the greatest description of that movie you could ever have. Nice and charming. It absolutely is that. Of Mice and Men, probably the best version of the story put the film. And it's a movie that's very weirdly close to my heart because I am originally from California, which is where the author John Steinbeck is from, and that's where all of his books are set. So every year, I think starting in fourth grade, we would have like a Steinbeck unit in school. So we'd read a book by Steinbeck, we'd watch a movie by Steinbeck, we'd go to the Steinbeck Museum, all that good stuff. So I've watched this movie a lot. And it's, you know, obviously a wonderful story. There's a reason it's a beloved novel, and it's pretty heart-wrenching stuff by the end of this. Like it's, but it's just well acted, well directed, well written, obviously, just a really fun movie. Wuthering Heights is a solid adaptation of a great, great, great novel. You could tell it's like they decided, okay, we're going to do this part of the book because we cannot make this into a movie shorter than 5 hours. So we're just going to, do this. It's not as good as like the Andrea Arnold version, which I think is easily the best Wuthering Heights that we have on screen, but it's good. It's a good movie. What else? Stagecoach. My favorite John Ford movie. I think it's really interesting to watch now because I think we think of Westerns as like its own thing and kind of stodgy and like blah, 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 but it's an action movie. Like the movie, like one of our lead characters, John Ford, is literally introduced cocking a shotgun. Like it's straight. Like there's not a big. There's John not Wayne. A lot of turns.
John Wayne.
Yeah. Did I say John Ford?
You said John Ford.
Yeah. John Wayne cocking a shotgun. It's a pretty. It's not many turns to go from this movie to like 80s action flicks. Like it really, it has all the stuff. It's got great action sequences. It's got a nice, cute little love story mixed in there, like just enough. It's a little less racist than a lot of other John Ford Westerns. So it's like, it's nice. It's good. It's enjoyable. And I'll watch this over The Searchers any day of the week. Like really, really fun Western action film.
I was genuinely surprised as well how accepting of kind of not progressive ideology as such, but fringe ideology in that particular film too. You know, John Wayne ends up John with Ford, a sex worker John, and it's like, wow.
Yeah, John Ford, shockingly progressive. Like, I think of John Ford before I watch his movies as, like, very right politically. And he's really, like, shockingly not. Like, you look back at the way, like, he looks at immigrants, the way he looks at sex workers, as you mentioned, even some of the ways he looks at race, like some of his movies mixed in with this kind of like, ooh, really questionable stuff about native folks. There's actually some interesting progressive ideas in there, which is always very surprising. But also this year, like probably one of the most well-known movies in the history of movies, The Wizard of Oz, kind of a big deal, also nominated this year. And I talked at length about how much I love The Wizard of Oz and how important it is to me on another podcast on Queer Now, which we've talked about before. So if you want to hear me blubber for an hour about how wonderful this movie is.
It's a really
is,
good episode, yeah.
You know, feel free. So yeah, I mean, The Wizard of Oz, like it is one of those when you do a podcast about it, you're like, God, what do I say about this? Like we have, it has been talked about by fucking everybody, by film scholars, by really smart, smart people. How do I come at this with a new perspective? But it's great. It's Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, it's Wizard of Oz. And also another Victor Fleming film, sort of, you know, another film that had multiple co-directors and people sitting in and out. I do want to suggest as well, if people haven't seen Wizard of Oz in a long time, go and pick up that 4K disc because it is heavenly. Oh my gosh, what and a stunning transfer.
And what better movie to find out if you really want or need 4K than a movie like that goes from sepia to the brightest possible Technicolor you can imagine. It is a shock to the system when it happens.
Quite literally, yeah.
yeah, absolutely. So, and then we have Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, another Frank Capra movie starring Jimmy Stewart. And this is a movie I am sure that I have seen before. I'm pretty sure we watched it in school when I was like 8 years old or something like that. I have no memory of it. Right. So it was basically like a new watch for me. And Andrew, like, this is up there with Capra's best. And anyone who knows me and knows how much I love It's a Wonderful Life knows how strong of a statement that is. But, and I kept thinking this movie is like so genuine that if you cast anyone other than Jimmy Stewart, I don't think this movie works at all.
It falls
like
apart.
You have to have someone you just inherently trust. Like, if this was made now, you cast Tom Hanks, right? Like, it has to be that level of care or maybe if you made it, I don't know, not to be a dick, but 15 or 20 years ago when Tom Hanks was a little bit younger, I don't think he could play a junior senator at this point in his career. But, like, you need someone of that caliber who you just, who's a good actor, but is also someone that everybody absolutely loves. And Jimmy Stewart really fits that bill. And, man, it's such a good movie, wasn't it?
Oh, look, this is probably my favorite out of the bunch. You know, Wizard of Oz is a masterpiece for sure. And one of the Ninotchka is also a really, really great film. But Mr. Smith Goes to Washington feels like it's precisely made for my sensibilities. And I had avoided it for so long, and I actually almost didn't watch it because part of me was like, you know, you read the plot description, I'm like, this feels like work. Like, this it feels does, like work.
Absolutely. I love that, like, I have slowly peer pressured you into watching these movies.
Yeah.
Like, it started out, you know, I'm just going to watch the winner. You do whatever you want, Dave. And now you're like, well, okay, maybe I'll watch.
Well, it helps, helps that these are good films.
Yes.
You know?
I mean, we're getting to that place where I think the Academy is starting to figure some stuff out. Like, there's some earlier years where I'm like, there's like 2 or 3 out of 10 that you're like, oh, that was really good. And the rest you're like, what, this? No one remembers this, and for good reason. But you mentioned Ninotchka. We'll talk about that in another episode. But that is my favorite out of the bunch. Like, that is the one. And I was so surprised by this because I'd never fucking heard of it. But we'll talk about that in our next episode. But now, Andrew, you have pussyfooted around and dodged long enough.
I delayed us for 10 minutes.
It is time to talk about the racist classic, Gone with the Wind. So, was this, if I remember right, this is a movie you hadn't seen before?
Seen half of it before. So I've seen the first half. She was tired and hungry. She's never going to do this again.
Yes.
Turns out she had to do it again. and then at the end, she's also kind of like, maybe I'll eat dirt. the end. That's Gone with the Wind, everybody. this is a miracle I find. All right, let's start talking about the direction first of all, okay? Because just like The Wizard of Oz, I find it a miracle that this kind of film did actually get made and coherently got made. Because we talk about, you know, we talk about something like Solo, Star Wars Story, which, you know, was pretty much completely directed, and then they went, no, we don't like that, let's get Ron Howard in. And I haven't seen it, but by all accounts, unless you're a Star Wars diehard faithful, it's a shit film. And yet,
I will say that I am not in that category, but, like, it's fine. I don't remember a goddamn thing about it, so it couldn't have been that bad. Because if it was bad, I would remember something about it. I wish it was bad. It's just like, oh yeah, that was a movie that happened.
It just exists. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So Gone with the Wind, and just like, again, The Wizard of Oz is essentially credited as a Victor Fleming film. Victor Fleming won Best Director for Gone with the Wind. However, George Cukor and Sam Wood also came in and did some directing, which Sam Wood was nominated for Goodbye, Mr. Chips in the same year. So it kind of maybe feels like a thank you for doing some effort on this film. but this is, you know, it's a 4-hour film about Scarlett O'Hara and Tara and Ashley and a whole bunch of American Civil War stuff. It's 1861. it's long. It's long. And then Rhett Butler also appears. I'm doing a great description of this too.
Yeah, it's excellent. It's great.
It's really fantastic.
Please circle the drain. I'm enjoying this. This is great.
Rhett Butler appears, who is the very strapping Clark Gable. This makes it three
films that
Clark Gable
man.
Has. Holy oh, he's shit, a beautiful man. And this is maybe the best he's looked.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. And I was thinking that as I was watching it, like, man, this guy was in a lot of Oscar-nominated movies.
And three Best Picture winners, you know?
Yeah.
It Happened One Night, Mutiny on the Bounty, and Gone with the Wind. Three very different performances, by the way.
And that's in less than a decade, right? We've only been doing 13 so far, right?
Yeah, 12? I mean, the show feels like it's been going for a decade.
Yeah, a little bit. Yes. I mean, for his career, like, within a decade in three Best Picture winners?
Yep.
That's pretty impressive stuff. Yeah. And it's not just like, oh, he was kind of a part of this. He was a big part of all those movies. Like, he was a star in all of those and held his own. It's pretty impressive stuff.
It really is. And yeah, I think that he's one of the great things about this particular film. It won, of course, a whole bunch of awards, 10 awards all up. So yeah, Best Picture, Best Director. And then also Vivian Leigh won for Best Actress as Scarlett O'Hara, and Hattie McDaniel won for Best Supporting Actress as Mammy, the servant, the slave servant, I guess is the best way of putting it. Look, I also want to sort of pre-phrase this particular discussion as being like, I am fairly ignorant to the whole American Civil War stuff. What I know about it comes through films. I didn't learn about it in high school. I didn't attend that particular year of history then. So, and while I should know a lot more, I also don't really have that much of an interest because I'm still learning about my own history in Australia.
Right.
And so I'm more focused on that. And it's not willful ignorance. I just, you know, there's only so much colonialism and aggression and fighting within one's own land that one can take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet if I watch Gone with the Wind and sat here and went, you know, this is my history lesson and rule of thumb,
don't
ever take a film as a history lesson. It should never be used as a history lesson. But if I use
especially
it as
not
a history,
this one.
Yeah. If I use it as a history lesson, then it seems that the North, who are the good people and who won, were actually bad. Yeah. Is this correct?
All right, so...
We should also prephrase this as well. That's not even the right word, but anyway, you're from the South. You live in the South now, Dave. Is this correct?
Well, I'm from the North. I live in the South. Let's get that straight, buddy. All right, so as I sat down to watch this movie, Andrew, I was like, okay, racist movie. I have to be aware when it was made. I got to be ready for the stereotype. Okay, I think I'm ready. And somehow, Andrew... this movie was more racist than I remembered. Like, from the opening crawl, like, from the little description that they gave at the start of the movie, where they're talking about, like, oh, a land lost to time, and, oh, what a shame that we don't have it. And then they have, like, little black children on a wheel. Like, I was just like, oh, my God. And even the, like, the characters you're supposed to like Scarlett O'Hara's dad, you know, like, later in the movie has some statement, like, well, you got to be nice to the people working for you, quote, especially the darkies. And I was like, holy fucking shit. Like, I forgot just how blatant this movie is. And you mentioned this kind of North versus South thing, and it's so interesting. And I can't believe it ever got made in this way. It's so interesting to watch a story from a goddamn loser's perspective go like, oh, those people in the North, those damn Yankees, they're so terrible. And like, not only saying it from that perspective, but there's all these sequences where it's like, oh, the Northern soldiers are out to rape the women and kill the men and they're animals. And I was just like, wow, I forgot about all of this. Like, it's a 4-hour movie that, like, before I watched it again, and granted, it's been, I think I mistakenly said when we were talking on a previous episode that it's been like at least 10 years. I don't think I've watched this since I was a kid. So it's probably like been like 30 years since I've seen this movie. And the things I remember, one, I thought the like, I'll never go hungry again was at the very end. It was in the goddamn middle. And I was like, oh, God, there's another 2 hours of this shit. And then I remember Clark Gable. Right. I remember especially the like, you know, I don't give a damn. You know, that bit. That's a really important bit.
Which
in
everybody
film history
seems to think is like the final line of the film. But then Scarlett goes on for this soliloquy, which is just like...
What is it? What is it that matters? man's the only thing that matters. It's the only thing that lasts.
Something you love better than me, though you may not know it. Terror. It's this from which you get your strength. Better the terror.
The man's the only thing that matters. It's the only thing that lasts.
Something you love better than me, though you may not know it. Terror. This from which you get your strength. Red Earth of Terra.
Well, land's the only thing that matters.
Something you love better than me.
Red Earth of Terra.
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 Terra. Home. I'll go home. And I'll think of some way to get him back. After all, tomorrow is another day.
You know, all right, no worries.
And okay, so here's what I'll say as far as good things about this movie. It is beautifully shot.
Wonderful shot.
I feel like George Cukor doesn't get enough credit for this movie because you can see his fingerprints. If you watched his other movies, you can see his fingerprints all over this movie. Like, this is the man that gave credit for it. God bless him, but nah, this is not your movie. Sorry to say. Beautifully shot. Looks like, especially for a movie from the 30s, looks like genuine. Like, it looks like you're in those towns. It looks like you're in that world. Wonderful. Great performances. Both Vivien Leigh and Clark Gable especially. Oh, my God. They're so amazing together. I mean, it helps that they're both, like, the pinnacle of human beauty in this movie. Like, they're very pleasant to look at. But they have this, like, fiery charisma together that, like, oh, my God. Like, Ashley, who gives a shit? That's the part that's the hardest for me to get behind, is her continuing to be in love with this fucking blonde nonsense when you've got Clark goddamn Gable right next to you. Like, what are you doing? No one is buying this. So they really work together. I mean, Hattie McDaniel is good, but it's like it's such a stereotypical role that it's hard for me. Like, I am glad. In some ways, I'm glad it exists. It was the first African-American Oscar winner. That's a beautiful moment. Watching tapes of her accept that award are really powerful. But it's such a racist role. It's like, I mean, there's a reason there is the mammy stereotype. Like, that, it's here. Here it is, all of it, right here in front of you. So that's really rough. But her performance is very good.
Yeah, and as well, obviously, there's Prissy, too, who played by Butterfly
McQueen.
That's the worst one.
That's the worst one. That's the worst. Like, I don't know nothing about Birth of No Babies, like, all this. And it's just so over the top, and you're like, it's painting black people as less intelligent, less capable, all this stuff, and I just...
I feel really sorry for that actress as well, because you can tell that she was directed that way. Be more shrill. Be more annoying.
Right.
You know?
And I remember watching this as a kid thinking, like, not knowing anything about racism or culture or what was being done, finding that character really funny. And I look back on it now and I'm like, ooh, this is not great. So there's so much that goes on. It's interesting because it's like, if you can, which you cannot, but if you could, like, remove all the horrible racism from this movie, which is hard to do because it's a feature of it, right? It's about the Civil War, so you're going to have that. But if you could possibly remove all of this, it's a good movie. It's well-performed. It's well-directed. It's beautiful to look at. But it's so hard for me in 2021 to be like, oh, except for, like, all the slave narratives, like, this is a really enjoyable movie. Because, like, from the first 5 minutes, I was already, like just kind of clenching my fists, like, kind of like, ooh, it's going to be a long sit. I don't know if I can get through this. This is a lot. But, like, you know, we talked about, you know, our two lead characters, but, like, our other lead female character, another kind of great performance as well. What's her name?
Olivia de Havilland.
which I just saw, and I just saw her recently in the Robin Hood movie. So it's like, and that's another great performance. Like, she's one of those kind of old Hollywood actresses that, like, people recognize the name, but I don't think really know much about her and who she was and the performances that she gave. But, like, her kind of genuineness and her kind of always doing the right thing, being this wonderful foil for Scarlett, I think is just kind of a stroke of genius for either from the original author or from the screenwriter. Like, it really, really works because it's a really interesting thing to do because you're following Scarlett through this whole thing, right? Mm. And she Let me not mince words. She is a fucking bitch. Like, she's terrible. She's a terrible person. But you're following her. She's your protagonist. So you half expect the movie to have Olivia de Havilland's character be a little underhanded, right? And so you can get behind Scarlett. But it never does that. Like, no, Scarlett is just a bad person. But the performance is so good that you're going to go along with it. And it's kind of a gutsy move from a screenwriting perspective.
Well, I do wonder if they made Scarlett so frustrating and so shrill and annoying because they needed to, like, she's our entry point to the South, effectively. Mm-hmm. And in a way, like, my reading of this film, I think it's fine. It's a 3-star film, really. You know,
That's
a good...
better than I expected from you.
Yeah. I can see why people still love it. I understand that, and there are some really wonderful pieces from a black perspective about appreciating and enjoying this particular film. I'll stick them in the show notes. But I look at a character like Scarlett, and in a way, she is such a bitch. She is such an unlikable person that because she is our entry point to the South, we can't help but see everything through her perspective and think, what you're working in and what you're working for is terrible too. The problem is the film doesn't believe that. The film does romanticize slavery. Yeah. It does romanticize the South so much that while you can read the film from that perspective, it is very hard to create a clear through line of that.
Does it feel like you're, like, doing gymnastics, though, to, like, to read it in a nice way, right? You're like, ooh, we got to be really flexible about this to read this in positive ways.
Well, I kept on coming at this film throughout, and I watched it over 2 days because, again, it's 4 hours long.
Same.
And, you know, and I think that really helped because I had the ability to go away, think about it, and come back and attack it from another angle. But for a film like this, you can't help but think, all right, why is this still so dearly loved? And you try and get on the wavelength of people who still love this particular film because there are people who are really passionate about it, really passionate about it. And that's interesting. It's a choice, you know, especially, again, you know, given the other nominees for this year and all that kind of stuff. But I find it fascinating why people still love this film. Is it the nostalgia, you know, things were better back then kind of perspective? But then on the same hand, I wonder as well, like, this denial of what actually happened and the reasoning for everything that happened, you know, I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that, like, the events that happened, like, we're recording this on the 2nd of April, well, 1st of April for you, but it's, you know, we're effectively 3 months removed from an attack on the Capitol in America. You know, your most sacred of places politically. And it's not hard to see a connection between the events that are depicted in Gone with the Wind and how romanticized it is and what happened on that day, where you still have this dual narrative of people who think that the South won or the South should have won. And we're effectively, what, 150 years removed from this happening? 160 years?
Yeah.
Like, fuck.
So, I think a lot of the love for this movie, there's some of what you talked about, and I think most of that is subconscious, except for the, like, virulent racists who really, you know, fly the flag and are like, the South will rise again and all that fucking horse shit. Like, those people, but, like, you know, they are, at least were, they seem to be a minority, right? But I think there is a, because this movie was released so long ago, it gets a pass from people on a lot of things. And it's, like, so big and so bold, and it's a melodrama. And it's like, it's playing to the back row. It's playing to the lowest common denominator. Like, you don't have to be a very smart person to get what this movie is putting down. Like, it is very, it wears it on its sleeve. So it's like, it's long, yes, but it's easy to understand where it's coming from. Unless you think a little bit more deeply about it, and then it's upsetting. And I think sometimes we talk about movies like this and we're always like, well, we're looking at it with 2021 eyes and blah, blah, blah. But I want you to listen to something that I just found online. So Carlton Moss, who was a black dramatist during the time, wrote an open letter, and he said, okay, hopefully you all know about The Birth of a Nation, maybe the most racist moneymaker in history, right? Just horribly, horribly offensive stuff. I do not recommend you watch it. It's disgusting, and you shouldn't watch it. But just know that it gave rise to the Ku Klux Klan coming back and painted black people as animals and rapists and murderers. Bad stuff, right? He said, The Birth of a Nation was a frontal attack on American history and the Negro people. Gone with the Wind was a rear attack on the same. Right? So this is what was said about it by actual black people during the 1930s. So this is not just us looking at this through a woke lens. Like, this is really offensive stuff and really disgusting, right? There are no full black characters in this movie. There are only stereotypes. It would be one thing if you had at least one character, one black character, like even if it was Mammy, who's like, okay, this is someone to care about. This is someone who lived a full life. All we get from her is that she cares about Scarlett, and she likes red dresses, I guess. Like, that's her thing. And that's it. Like, and other than that, she's mainly there to mug at the camera and to yell and to be over the top. That's not a full character. Prissy certainly is not a full character. Any of the other slaves that work on the farm are not full characters. And worse, they are shown as people who are loyal to the O'Haras. There's not a single moment of like, fuck this, I am out of here. Like, Civil War is on, I'm going to escape. There's none of that. It's all like, we're just happy working hard, which is maybe even more damaging than the other stereotypes in the movie. You know, painting not just some, but all of these black folk in the South as like, well, we were really happy just to work on this farm for no money. Like, come on. Like, this is disgusting.
And
it's so hard for me to separate that from the rest of the movie. Like, yeah. I was just like, honestly, like, I watched this over 2 days. I watched the first hour one day and then 3 hours the next day. And I honest to God, I was just in a bad mood for 4 hours. Like, I was just, ugh, I don't like this feeling because there's so much bad about it. It's a good movie that has an ugly message that treats anyone not white and rich terribly.
Yeah.
You know, just, ugh. And it's like, there's not enough, honestly, there's not enough Clark Gable for me to get behind this movie. Because, like, anytime he's not on screen, I'm like, I'm over this, honestly. But anytime he's on screen, he's got so much charm and so much charisma, and he works so well with everyone in this movie, like, whether it be Scarlett or whether it be Olivia de Havilland's character, like, there is a give and take there that's really fun. And if the movie was just that, I'd be all in on this movie. It wouldn't need to be 4 hours. It would be charming and fun. It would be a romantic comedy. It would be great. But unfortunately, it's like, no, let's focus on the farm and let's focus on this, you know, this dead girl on a horse. And like, oh, God, who cares? Like, I'm so done with this movie. I own this movie, and it felt like it's a movie like, oh, well, you got to own that, right? It's Gone with the Wind. It's Wizard of Oz. It's like fill in the Lawrence of Arabia, whatever the movie is. It's like, oh, it's a classic. I should own it. And now I kind of regret this movie, because I don't, unless I do it for another podcast, like, I'm never watching this again.
I'll never watch this again. Yeah.
There's no way. And it's not just a length thing. I've watched Lawrence of Arabia 3 times in the last 2 years, and that's 4 hours long too. But this is just like, there's not enough good to get me through all the just not even bad, but just hideousness that surrounds this movie. And it's like, and the worst part about the hideousness that's in it is it doesn't ever reckon with it. It doesn't ever take a close look about how awful this situation is. It's about how great the South was. And I'm like, yeah, South, not great. Not great during the 1800s, man. Like, people, like, not only was slavery a thing, but, like, slavery is propped up by murder. Like, murder and torture. That's what supposedly these black people were like, oh, I would never want to leave. Like, all right, come on. Like, your whole family has been murdered and separated, and you were sold as livestock. I think you want to leave. I think, and not to say that there weren't black folk during that time that stayed, right? That did happen. But in this, it's like 100% of them wanted to stay, and worse, wanted to protect poor Scarlett.
Yeah.
Like, I was like,
exactly. And then the carpetbagger who they meet, who comes up to Tara, is like this grotesque figure of this black person dressed in like this, you know, exuberant garb and very much
the
like,
bad ones, Andrew.
Yeah, he's like one of the bad ones. Yeah, and I mean, I don't understand. This is, again, coming like treating a film like a history lesson. I don't know what a carpetbagger is or why they had that name. It sounds different. But on the same hand, it's just like the film isn't holding your hand, and that's fine. It's not intending to do that. It suggests that everybody who watches it should already have a appreciation of American history and all that kind of stuff, but that's fine. This is not the first time that kind of film has won Best Picture. We look at Cavalcade and the camera move to showing the ring and the Titanic and stuff like that, which is, you have to know what has gone on, that kind of thing. I've written in my notes as well that Gone with the Wind plays like a forefather to Zero Dark Thirty, in the sense that we're not this kind of lack of interrogation of the actual subject matter, the core subject matter of the film, and the just like, yeah, it's not bad, like slavery, not bad, torture, not bad, kind of thing. And it's just, and there are defenders. So the reason why that film came to mind is that there are so many stringent and strong defenders of something like Zero Dark Thirty and like Gone with the Wind, because people benefited from it. And it's hard to take something that people might have generally had a direct influence or a benefit from, and especially if the your lineage comes from people who owned slaves in America. It's hard to break that, especially when they might be one or two, two, three generations removed.
It's not that long ago, man.
Happening. Yeah. It's not that long ago. And it's hard to look at your grandparents or your grandparents' grandparents and say, they were bad people. It's hard to do that.
It is, yes.
And it's
I totally agree.
I understand that. But on the same hand, if they owned slaves, they were bad people.
Right? Yeah. There were lots of bad people throughout history. Sorry, one of them was your mama or whatever, but they're bad people. You have to reckon with that. And that, again, is what is so upsetting about this movie to me, is you can't say, oh, it's just the time. This was, almost 100 years, 70, 75 years after slaves were freed. At this point, yes, obviously, virulent racism existed in the 1930s and 40s. But imagine the 1930s and 40s being like, yeah, slavery was a good thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's what this movie is saying. And it's so wild to me, because it feels like a movie that was made in 1870. Like, it's just like if that, I'd be a lot more accepting of it. Like, okay, we're only like 5 years past like this being outlawed. Okay. Still don't like it, but okay, let's move forward. But like 1937, 1938, like enough time has passed that you should know. It'd be like making a movie in Germany in 1970 and being like, you know what? Killing Jewish people, not that bad. Like, what? Like, that's crazy. That's a crazy thing to say. And yet, it's interesting, because when we get to talk about, like, does this film matter, it's going to be really difficult, because it's, like, such a known quantity.
Difficult for you. It's not difficult for me.
One thing I didn't say about this movie, I did say it was good to look at, but, like, one of the things I posted on Twitter, because I'm an asshole, about this movie was the gif of, great gowns, beautiful gowns. Because this movie, like, the costuming in this movie, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like, some of the best ever. Like, I don't care if you're what time period you're talking about. Like, this stunning, stunning work here. Like, just beautiful suits, beautiful gowns. Everyone looks perfect in this movie. And not in the way where everyone looks, like, sometimes everyone looks perfect in the way where everyone looks, like, a little bit above their station. Right? Like, too nice? And I don't think you get that here. Like, you get, like, even the soldiers' uniforms are, like, distressed and dirty in the right way. Like, you can tell a lot of care was taken in this movie. Mm. And that's, I think, the best thing I can say about it, is that, like, a lot of care was taken here. I mean, I was reading up on the background of this movie. I mean, they delayed it for 2 years because the director wanted Gable so bad. And I was like, that, sir, was the right choice.
Oh, yeah.
I would not say that about very many actors. And I guess they, like, did this huge search for Scarlett O'Hara. They had, like, 1,400 women audition for this role. And, like, at first they wanted Betty Davis, but she said no. you know, there were a bunch of like either famous or soon to be famous actresses that were thought about for this movie. And honestly, Vivien Leigh, I can't imagine a better Scarlett O'Hara. Like, given what the script demands, like, yes, she is not a likable character. She is over the top. She is melodramatic. But, like, that's baked in. Like, this is not an indictment of Vivien Leigh's acting or her performance. Like, that's just who Scarlett O'Hara is. So I think she played it perfectly. I don't really enjoy the movie because of all the stuff that goes on around it, right? But both her and the male lead are just so great. Like, I just, that is the only reason I would pop this back in again, is maybe like just jump to the scenes they have together, because they're really enjoyable. Like, it's even out of context. Like, you don't even need the rest of the movie. Just watching the two of them together kind of banter back and forth, and it's really fun. Like, even the first time they kind of meet, where she's like throwing stuff at the wall, like, and almost hitting him, and then she has to explain that away. Like, that stuff is kind of magical and kind of fun. Like, I was like, let's follow these two.
There's some chemistry there.
Leave Tara behind. Yeah. Just go live in a little house and, you know, fight amongst yourselves. It'll be great. Yeah. You know, like, it'll be enjoyable. But, like, there's so much other bullshit in this movie that I'm like, ugh, I don't know, man.
So there's two things I want to talk about as well. The main interest for Scarlett is, of course, Ashley Wilkes, played by Leslie Howard. And, all right, so why do you think... Why is Scarlett so obsessed with Ashley Wilkes? Is it because he is the forbidden fruit that she can't have? And, you know, obviously, as we see at the end, after everybody else has died and it's just her and Ashley left, and she finally gets him, that she kind of thinks, well, I don't want him anyway, you know, because the conquest, the search for him is more entertaining and exciting for her than actually getting him himself. But also, do you feel that there is some kind of love and affection for Ashley? Because, you know, prior to, long way before this, Scarlett gets married, and then, you know, with it, I love how quickly this film dispatches of people. It clearly yeah. does not care about some of the peripheral characters at all. And given this film is 4 hours long, it is very easy to forget that she was married, and literally the very next scene he is dead, and later on
I just had to remind myself of who you were talking about. I was like, she was married?
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, him,
that poor fucking schlub.
Yeah,
he was so in love with her and she was using him. Yeah, that guy.
And
yeah,
then later on that she has a kid, and then that her kid dies as well, and it's like, you know, that's a whole sequence which goes for about 15 minutes of, you know, what's his face? Rhett taking the kid over to London and stuff, and then she's like, I want to go back to mum, and then goes back to mum, and then the kid dies. But, yeah, like...
I'm sorry to laugh, but that scene is, like, so comical. Like, the way that child dies. Like, I mean, it's so...
Well, as I messaged to you, it is very Dexter's son falling off the treadmill. You know, and yes. I, for some reason, I continually bring in that show up. This is the second time I've mentioned it on this particular podcast, but,
I mean, know, it's just like, it's so obvious what's going to happen, and her like, oh, just like dad. And it's like, okay, that kid's fucking dead. Like, yeah. There's no, and then the way it's filmed is comical. I mean, it's a kid falling ass over tea kettle off a horse. I mean, it's funny. Like, and this is actually one of my big issues with the movie is, and this ties back in to the Ashley thing. There are things that the movie wants you to care about, but they're done so poorly that you don't. So, no, I don't think she has any real love for Ashley. I don't think she ever did. And I don't think it's just – I don't think it's only that he was forbidden fruit. It's kind of that, but it's a sideways look at that. The problem isn't that he's forbidden. The problem is that he chose someone over her. That's the issue.
His cousin.
Yeah. She cannot fathom the idea that anyone would choose anyone else. And I get it. She's hot. Like, yeah, you have hot people problems. That's, yeah, of course. But none of that matters. Like, they throw in all these scenes of them, like, supposedly flirting. And it makes me feel bad because Leslie Howard's a very good actor. I'd mentioned a movie he has been in on this podcast before. He was the lead in Pygmalion. Wonderful performance, wonderful actor, but there's not very much for him to do here. right? He's like, hug his wife, cheat on her, kind of, like, that's it. And there's not much here. He's just there to be kind of side, right? So you don't get a real sense, because Scarlett is a character that is not likable and doesn't have a lot of, like, human characteristics. Like, she is more like a lizard than a human being. So it's, like, very hard to imagine her caring for him in any way. So all these moments of, like, oh, it should have been me. And I was like, eh, should it, though? And the only time there is any amount of humanity in her is when she's with Rhett, because he's the only one who has the fucking balls to challenge her on her bullshit, right? Ashley does not. The worst that he does is say, like, I'm not going to be with you. He doesn't ever challenge her. He doesn't ever say, like, I don't love you. I don't care about you. I care about her. He's not strong enough to do that, which I get. Again, she's very hot. I understand that. But, you know, so that stuff never works. So there's, like, all these characters that, like, they want you to care about. And it's amazing that in a 4-hour movie, they couldn't manage it. There's only three characters that you care about in this movie, in a 4-hour movie. And that is a shame. Because, well, I think there's work to be done with those characters.
Yeah.
But like you said, they just shunt them off to the side so quickly, and we get back to Scarlett and Pretty Dresses. So, like, all this work is kind of for naught.
Yeah, exactly. And I one of the things I find really interesting is that they equally wrap Scarlett up in cotton wool, actively doing so and protecting her for so many things. But then the same hand there, it's like there's somebody who is continually applying new cotton wool, while on the other hand, there's somebody who's pulling it off. Like, going, look at this spot here and look at this spot here. One of the other things which I wanted to touch on, which I find really interesting, is do you think that Gone with the Wind would be a more fascinating or contextually better approach film if Melanie Hamilton, Olivia de Havilland's character, was the lead character? Because I look at this film and I keep on wondering what kind of narrative this would... I don't think it would be as well-loved. Because I think that part of the reason why people like this film is because Scarlett is both an interesting and engaging person, equally dislikable, but also very entrancing. Melanie is not that person. Olivia de Havilland is great here. She is really, really great. But on the same hand, she does actions that feel more in tune with what the narrative is saying. And what I mean is in the sense that when Scarlett starts up a business and works with the people from the North, and, you know, everybody around her, including Melanie, is like, how could you do this? How could you set up a lumberjack business and work with the people of the North? They're still our enemies. And yet Scarlett is like, well, I still got to earn money, you know? And that's the only kind of moment of cohesiveness and an acceptance that the old world no longer exists and I've got to move forward with the new world. And yet Melanie is like, I will never do business with those people at all. And for me, Melanie seems like the kind of the white woman nowadays who is like, she is reserved, and on the surface you think that she might be a little bit more accepting of change and things like that, but she's very stuck in her ways. You know, I am the wife who has to stay home, have kids, and look after the house and tend to it all. Whereas Scarlett actually gets out and does work in the fields as much as she whinges about it. She does do all of these kinds of things. She has action and agency in a way that Melanie feels constrained by. Yeah.
I will say, though, the movie takes that opportunity to have her work in the field so they can place her once again over the lazy savages who work on the farm.
Yeah.
Like, she never complains, and they always do, which is disgusting. But I get what you're saying. Here's what I'll say. General blanket statement. This movie would not be as popular, but would be better if you focused on literally any character other than her. Because she's one note. She's one thing. She's overdramatic. She yells a lot. She's never going to be stopped. That's boring to me. Follow Melanie. Fine. Follow Mammy. Show me what she's like behind the scenes when Scarlett isn't there, when she's talking to her friends, and have this fucking crazy white lady show up every 25 minutes or so to, like, yell and scream and tear her dress and do nutso stuff, and then go back to her story. I think that would be really interesting. Also interesting, go from Rhett Butler's perspective, right? You get to see this woman kind of coming into his life a couple different times. You get to see him being captured by the army and trying to work his way out of that situation, trying to, like, make his way in the world. also a more interesting movie. I think it's like shock. Like, it's kind of surprising me. I think sometimes when you watch a movie that's this beloved and you don't like it very much, like, I think this is a fine movie. This is kind of a middle of the road movie. I can understand why people like it, but it's not for me, and that's fine. But when a movie is this beloved, I think sometimes we work really hard and we contort ourselves to like it more than we do, because you're like, oh, I gotta be missing something. Like, there's gotta be, what do you weirdos like about this that I am completely missing? And I think this is a movie that, like, I have doubts about people who truly love this movie. Like, I have concerns. Like, because one of two things are happening. You're completely ignoring cultural context, which I think is pretty damaging in this movie, or you're lying. Or you're saying, like, no, I like it because it's a 5-star movie. Everyone loves Gone with the Wind. And it's a very easy thing to fall into when a movie wins this many Oscars. I think, you know, I like this movie, but you could say the same thing about Titanic. You know, oh, it won 11 Oscars. It must be great, blah, blah, blah. And you fall into that, like, ready to like a movie. And I think there's a lot of that going on here. And I think there's a lot of improvements that could be made about this movie. I mean, you take it from any other angle, and I think this is a really interesting story, because I can't think of things much more boring, like following a lady who is really rich, really high class, and complains about her life constantly. Like, that's fucking boring. But if she does that every 25 minutes in reference to another interesting character who is actually struggling to survive, that's interesting to me, and there's a lot to be gleaned from that.
So, do you think that, like, for me, I see that this film obviously is a major Best Picture winner. It's one of the ones that people continually talk about when they think of Academy Awards. They think of films like Gone with the Wind. They think of films like Titanic as being a Best Picture winner. And, you know, once again, this is the 12th Academy Awards, and, you know, we're recording this, and this will come out just after the 92nd Academy Awards. And so we've got 92.5 films that have been won Best Picture. And yet, when people think of Best Picture winners, they tend to think of, like, a handful of, like, 10 films. You know,
right.
Gladiator, Gone with the Wind, that kind of stuff.
Green Book.
I mean, Green Book, yeah. Rain Man. Yeah, and so I wonder how much, for the people who do love this film, I wonder how much that status as being a major Best Picture winner actually plays into their affection of it. Does it play into it at all? I find it really curious.
I bet it does. I mean, it's so hard to ignore, right? I mean, it would be like, so I have a lot of friends online who are in, like, their, you know, early 20s to early 30s, right? And I bet they feel the same way about something like Silence of the Lambs. Like, you can't ignore that won, like, every major award. Just like I go into this thinking, like, oh, this is one of the big Oscar winners. Whenever people rank the Oscar winners, this is usually in the top 5 or top 10 of all these 92 and a half movies. And you're like, okay, this is the one. And, like, I think it's hard to, like, it's hard to negate that. It's hard to separate that. It's also, you know, hard to separate virulent, awful racism. So, but you know, that's six of one, half a dozen of the other.
It's like,
don't even out, right?
Who is it hard to separate for? Because, like,
look, I truly think that even people my age, and I'm in my 40s, we do make the mistake of looking at these old movies and thinking, like, oh, we didn't know any better. It's fine. And then you start reading up on, like, what people of color at the time were saying, and were like, no, we should have known better. Like, this is a fucking problem. But I think we forgive all this stuff, and we're like, well, it was 1937. It's fine. It's not a big deal. Let's just, you know, it's very much the same argument as separating the art from the artist, you know, like, it's that kind of thing. We're like, well, we have to forgive it, because, like, that's not what this is about, you know. But, like, in the case of this movie, like, it is what it's about. Like, this is not a thing where it's like, oh, it's an ancillary thing. Like you cannot do a good job of talking about this movie and not bring up race. It's set during the end of the fucking Civil War. Civil War is all about race. No matter what people in the South tells you, it was not about states' rights. It was about states owning human beings and profiting off them for generations, you know, through terrorism and torture and murder. Like, that is what the Civil War was about. That's what they want to keep. So, like, you can't. I don't think you can, in good conscience, you can't separate that. Mm. That has to be a part of your discussion. You can have a discussion about liking this movie as long as you talk about that stuff too, right? You can't negate it. Like, it's just impossible. Like, and I heard, and it's really interesting because we'll talk about this eventually, sadly, but people tried to do the same thing with Green Book, where it was like, oh, well, it's not really about race. It's not, like, oh, yeah, it kind of is, man.
It literally
man.
Is,
like,
yeah.
It literally, that's the plot. Like,
and it's in the title. It's a right, literal. Right.
Yeah.
So I you know, this is I don't know how many 20-something-year-old listeners we have, if we have any at all. Looking at the stats, our listener base is predominantly 30-something men from America and Australia. And thank you very much for those 30-something men.
I like that I'm bringing in the young folks, the 30-somethings. Good.
But I'm genuinely curious what somebody who's just turned 20, like a 19-year-old turned 20, what their thoughts are on this particular film, how they feel about it, you know, that kind of thing. Because I look at a film like Gone with the Wind, and besides the distinct difference in quality, you know, and the distinct difference in acting and direction and stuff like that, it's hard to look at this and think there is a major overlap with something like Cimarron. And look, I'm as surprised as you are that, you know, the one film that we continually bring up on this darn podcast is fucking Cimarron, you know, but
it's you just had to bring in the hot take. Like, you know what? Not that bad. Kind of like that.
Yeah. Film. Yeah. I can't live that down. But on the same hand, I keep on thinking about it because of the fact that it kind of typifies what a Best Picture winner can be in so many different ways. And Gone with the Wind, again, quality aside and all this kind of stuff, is no different than Cimarron. The narrative is very apologetic. The narrative is very, this is how it is and this is how it was, and a lot of us think this is how it should still be. And so
if Cimarron was prettier, it would be a better movie. That's exactly what I'm telling you, Andrew.
Yeah.
If it had hot-ass people in it, then I would be like, okay.
Excuse me.
Good movie.
Excuse me. Yancey Cravat.
He is no Clark Gable, my friend. He is no Clark Gable. Who is? But he is no Clark Gable. And there is no female equivalent to Vivian Leigh in Cimarron, I am sorry to say.
This is true. This is true. The the wife in that film just literally disappears.
Hot or not edition. This is how you know I don't want to talk about a movie. Let's talk about how hot people are. That'll be fun for me.
Right. So I usually wouldn't ask this because this is not that kind of show. But I feel that it would be a disservice. Yeah, I feel it would be a disservice to our listeners if we didn't possibly recommend a film that might be, like, if you are going to watch Gone with the Wind, what is a film that you should watch alongside this as to give yourself context for this particular film and the narrative that's taken place?
Interesting. So, let's see, a Southern narrative, Civil War.
Well, it doesn't even need to be about that, because the film that comes to mind for me is Ava DuVernay's 13th, which is about the continuation of slavery in modern times. And it does look at what the whole Civil War, like, I understand there was a change to the Constitution, and effectively there was a loophole that basically said slavery's bad unless it's in these situations. And I feel that is a really important film to watch alongside this, because it's like, look at all of this that happened, and yet look at what's still going on. We can romanticize it as much as you want, but the reality is that there are still a proportion of African-American people who are, you know, greatly represented in the prison system. There is far too many Black Americans in the prison system, and they're kept there under the guise of slavery. So that's a film that comes to mind as something that, yeah.
Yeah, and I would argue that The 13th is the best thing that Ava DuVernay has ever done.
I think it's
incredible. I think it's one of the few pieces of work in the last couple decades that I think literally everyone should watch.
Yep.
Like, you should see it, you should know it. We talked about movies not being a history lesson. That one is.
Yeah.
And it should be seen. Honestly, you know, there's, of course, thousands, or at least hundreds of movies about slavery and Black pain, and, like, it seems to be a go-to for Hollywood always gets Oscar attention as well. But the one I keep thinking about right now is 12 Years a Slave, specifically because, you know, for better or worse, depending on, you know, your view of it, it does show the torture of slavery and a little bit closer to what it was really like. And even that movie, with all of the grotesque things it shows, doesn't even scratch the surface. Like, if you actually do some research about the terror of slavery, like, it's like, I mean, people were skinned alive. Like, people were, their children were murdered in front of them. Like, babies were taken from them and murdered. This is like, think of the worst things you can imagine and like times it by 1,000. Like, it's horrific. But it also, this movie also shows you an educated black man during this time, who was not a slave and who left and was living his life and was relatively happy, and what it's like to be dragged back into that, as opposed to a movie like Gone with the Wind, which shows the complete mythhood of the happy slave and the loyal slave, the person who would want to stay at Terra through all that. Not only stay at Terra after they could have been free, but like, man, Terra fucking sucks. That place is terrible. Like, it's falling apart. Like, come on, man. You got to hit the road. You got to go. Like, so kind of having those things be so opposite is really interesting to me. And it, and also, it's just, like, it's a great movie. Yeah. Stephen Queen's a great director. Like, it's fantastic. But I don't think, I don't, to show you, like, how black pain on screen can be painful, even for someone like me who has no kin to that time, right? I've only watched it once. I watched it in the theaters, and it's a hard watch.
It's like, a very hard watch, yeah.
And makes it very different from Gone with the Wind, which, like, kind of, like, brushes aside all the terribleness, right? This shows all the terribleness, and it shows how hideous white folk were during that time. At least it gives you just a little bit of taste of it, and never makes it silly, never makes it funny.
It's like Django Unchained does, yeah.
That's
yeah.
exactly what I was just thinking of, yeah. And this makes it deadly, deadly serious, and it's very impactful.
Yeah.
So that's the movie I would recommend. I had a question for you. Where do you rank Gone with the Wind in this year's Oscar nominees? Is it the worst of the bunch that you saw, or?
Yeah, look, I think it is. Yeah. And look, again, as I said, like, it's a 3-star film. It's not a dud of a film. There are positive aspects here, but I keep on coming back to, it's the perennial question which I have is, like, geez, what would the history be like if Wizard of Oz won? You know, what, yeah. Like...
A better time.
You know, we don't... It takes until Oliver in 1969 for a kid's film to properly win. And Gone with the Wind is, you know, it's fine, but Wizard of Oz is a genuine inspiration for so many people. And... You know, I look at Spike Lee. It's Spike Lee's favorite film. And, you know, it's...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And when you know that and you look at his filmography, you're like, okay, I can see tendrils of that. And it's like, you know, for Wizard of Oz, yeah, there are... I think that somebody had said that basically every film after The Wizard of Oz is a remake of The Wizard of Oz. And I can understand that. You know, like, there is no film more impactful in so many ways than Wizard of Oz, and yet I look at Gone with the Wind.
It might be the greatest coming of age story ever put on film.
Oh yeah,
like
I mean, shit, yeah.
and that's such a standard of film and of novels as well. But the coming of age story is a big deal. And like, when I watched it again recently as an adult, I was like, this is a great, great coming of age story.
It holds up in so many different ways. It is such a brilliant, brilliant film. For me, like,
and it's a movie you don't expect to hold up. It's a movie you think, like, it's a kid's movie. I'm not going to be into this. And then you watch it as a fucking, you know, 30 to 40 year old man. You're like, this is magical. This is wonderful. And how often does that happen with, I mean, it is a kid's movie, right? And yet it feels like it brings out that kid in you, but also feels like a movie you can enjoy as an adult.
Oh, yeah. And you see everything in a whole different light there. So, yeah, I mean... Again, I didn't see Dark Victory, I didn't see Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and I didn't see Wuthering Heights, but I would put Gone with the Wind down the bottom, just because, you know, I will hold a film like Stagecoach up, and I will rewatch Stagecoach in the future. I probably won't rewatch Off Mice and Men. I saw it, you know, a long time ago, but I appreciated it then. I really enjoyed Love Affair. I thought that was really good. I, you know... Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and Ninotchka are both films that very likely upon rewatch will be in my top 100 of all time. You know, and Wizard of Oz is already there. And, you know, it's hard to look at a film that I have to paint around the edges and color in the edges and all this kind of stuff and go, well, you know, it's got this, which is good, but, you know, then it's also got this. Like, you make excuses for it for so many different reasons, and it's hard to look at a film like this and go, yeah, it deserved to win Best Picture.
I mean, personally, I can't wait till our next episode, because then I get to talk about the movie that should have won Best Picture.
Yeah.
So that'll be...
Yeah, but I just... I think it leads to the final question, which we always ask. And for you, it might be a little bit harder, but for me, I already know the answer, and it's that this film doesn't matter. And I know that it might be hard for some people to listen to, but I don't think it does matter. And I find it very interesting. You know, way back when we were discussing, you know, Best Picture winners and nominees and stuff like that, I had proposed talking about BlacKkKlansman as the companion film for this. I haven't revisited that since it was in cinemas, but part of the reason why I mentioned that was because Spike Lee does use clips from Gone with the Wind in that particular film, and yet now I've seen Gone with the Wind all the way through, I realize that that film is not really a commentary on this particular film at all, and I know that he uses in his education and stuff like that for film students, he does use Gone with the Wind as an example for people to understand, because it's easier to use this than something like Birth of the Nation, as you mentioned. But I just feel like I don't want to see the film that the modern filmmaker watches Gone with the Wind and is inspired to make a film by, if that sentence makes sense. I don't want to see the film where somebody says, I wish we made more films like that, because we don't need that. We've moved past that as a society. We really do not need that as a whole. So for you, does it matter? Does it still?
It matters with caveats. So you're right. We don't need quote unquote more movies like Gone with the Wind. If you're talking from a cultural lens, no, we don't. But the idea of a big, brash Hollywood production, I like that idea. And so do the Oscars. Like this movie, like whether it should matter or not, it fucking has mattered. Like, the Academy eats this shit up. So, like, you know, these big sprawling epics that look beautiful, that have beautiful stars, that work well together. Like, I'm fine with making more movies like that as long as it's not fucking racist. Like, we can have movies like that. So I think it matters in the sense of the style of movie it is, and it's also like from an Oscars perspective, like, yes, it's fun to have an Oscars where like you've got like 25 different movies that are nominated. It's also fun when you have like a juggernaut, when you have that movie that gets nominated for like 27 awards and you're like, oh my God, I would love this movie. Like whether it was like Lord of the Rings or it was Titanic or it was Silence of the Lambs, or even before this when we did It Happened One Night, that was another one that got nominated for so many awards. That is a fun thing to happen. So a movie that like the idea that a movie can like capture the imagination of the general audience is really powerful and shockingly rare when it comes to the Oscars.
Yeah, when it usually taps into Oscars, a zeitgeist, it makes it...
Right.
It makes right. The... and I know that this isn't what this show is about, but it makes the Oscars feel important. You know, people...
Yes, yes.
They often, you know, clutch at pearls and stuff like that. Oh, not enough people are watching the actual ceremony itself, and it's like, who fucking cares? You know, like, get over yourself.
But I guarantee you that year that Titanic was up, people were watching.
Yeah, exactly. People were watching.
Because it's a movie they saw. Like, so it matters in the sense of a, like, what it really looks like when a movie hooks in to the popular opinion and is also a well-produced, quote-unquote, good movie. So there's a difference between, you know, a movie that's purely just a crowd pleaser. Like, and those movies are fine, right? Popcorn movies are great. We talked about it before. I just watched Godzilla versus King Kong. Should that win Oscars? No. Does it matter? Probably not. But I had a great time. Like, I, you know, threw popcorn down my fat gullet and I watched a monkey beat up a lizard and it was great. But when you combine that kind of like emotional attachment with a movie going experience with also a good movie, they get... there's something special about that. There's like a moment there. So it matters in that sense, But, like, all the other extraneous stuff, like, nah. But it matters as a cultural moment more than it does as a movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's the exact defense I made of Cimarron.
Yeah, but I'm right and you're wrong, though, because nobody remembers Cimarron, and for good reason, because it sucks.
I can guarantee you, when we get to something like Out of Africa, I'm going to be mentioning Cimarron still.
There's a bunch of racist shit at Cimarron, too, and you defended that, but this...
Yeah, but my defense of... And look, as we move further away from that film, my defense was... And my defense of Cimarron applies to a film like Gone with the Wind, because my defense of that was we need to remember what we came from and the perspectives that were had at the time. And yet, watching Gone with the Wind, it reminds us every single minute of what the perspectives were at the time. There were people who thought right. that this was not a bad idea. And the reality is...
A lot of people.
A lot of people. And the reality is a lot of people still think that it's not a bad idea. And
right.
So, you know, I'd like to formally retract my statement that Cimarron matters. It doesn't matter. Because on the same hand that Gone with the Wind doesn't matter.
This coward just retracting his statements left and right when they're not popular. I see.
But my reasoning is that the more that we watch these films and the more that, you know, I don't know what your history was with the films from the 1930s and stuff like that. I hadn't watched as many as I had liked to. And I'm glad that we're going through these films and we're moving into the 1940s now where my film history is more, I have a more of a steeped film history from the 40s and 50s. But it's good to have an understanding of that history and appreciate how films were made and what stories were being told and how they were being told too. And that sounds so fucking reductive because it's literally what we talk about all the time online and stuff like that. But I think there's a difference between talking about it and actually practicing and doing it, because people say, you know, Oh, but I got to watch Justice League, which is 4 hours long, and I'm going to watch it again. And all power to you if that's your thing. But just like if you are a film lover and you are a film enthusiast, branch out. There are films made prior to the year 2000. You know,
know the history of it. I think it's an important point you're bringing up. And basically, you're just, you know, parroting Martin Scorsese, which I'm always a big fan of, because that's one of the things he has talked about. Not only in terms of world cinema now, but like older cinema. Like everything that you like about movies came from somewhere. So like, you know, do your homework. Read your history textbook. And in this case, it's really, in some cases, really fun movies you get to watch. That like, in some cases, that movies that no one else you know have seen.
Yeah.
Right? And you get to like experience this for the first time and like have something kind of private and something kind of cool that you get to experience that not a lot of people do. And like most of these things are like free or cheap. Like you can rent these movies for like $2. Right? And they're all at your goddamn fingertips, right? You just turn on your TV or open your computer and you go to Amazon or wherever and you just rent all these movies from the past. And you just, like, it's one of those things, like, I think sometimes we forget just how lucky we are to live in the time we do. Like, when I was 20, you know, 22 years ago, I couldn't just, like, log on and I had to, like, track stuff down. Right? You have to depend on Blockbuster or Hollywood Video or whatever. And now you don't have those problems. Like you can do what I do for this show. I look up, okay, what got nominated? Okay, I'm going to track down those movies. And it takes me like 10 minutes to track down all of them. And they're just like, oh, now I can just watch them. That's cool. And that's fun. So it's like, for me, this has been like a really fun experiment to like really get myself a little bit of an education. Like granted, it's a small sample, right? 10 movies a year, maybe, which is such a small amount, but you do get to see like what was popular at that time and what we were awarding. And I think it's always like, yes, awards are nonsense when it comes to art. Like you shouldn't rank art and all that stuff. But I think it's interesting and important to know what we as a society value, right, in art. And that is what these awards are doing, right? Like it's showing what we value as a people. Specifically as an American people, because they're American awards, but it shows us like what matters to the people of that time. And I think that's interesting just to keep it all in context. Yeah.
And
that's why Green Book sucks and shouldn't have won.
Exactly. That's and, you know, there are going to be some confronting films like Gone with the Wind. that are going to confront mm-hmm. your ideas of what a good film should be. But I think that one of the other aspects in, you know, given this is a long film, hence why we have a longer episode and discussion and stuff like that, but I do want to kind of lead into the wrap-up of this is saying one of the things, a side effect that I didn't expect from having these discussions and doing this particular podcast is that it has opened up my perspective and my purview of the different people that I now talk to online. There is a whole group of people who don't engage with superhero films as much as everybody else does, don't engage with modern films as much as everybody else does. And yet now there are people who I didn't, you know, I may have followed them on Twitter or whatever, but now I'm having active discussions with them about these older films. And I'm getting a catalogue of films that I'm getting a film history lesson myself. And hopefully, you know, they're too getting a film history lesson as well. And I can see that there is a tangible effect of people going, you know what, I might watch Ninotchka again. You know, I've never seen this film. I might check it out and that kind of stuff. And that, I think, is probably one of the most enjoyable aspects, besides talking to yourself, Dave, of course.
Well, you said one of. I am obviously the most important. Yep. I get that.
But one of the most enjoyable aspects has been being able to engage with people who I wouldn't usually have talked to and who I usually wouldn't have maybe had these discussions with. And there is a whole bunch of different films that I've been recommended and stuff like that that I would never have sought out otherwise. So this is my own little film history lesson. I'm glad that we're doing it because, you know, while we do have to watch 4 hours of Gone with the Wind, you know, there is a whole bunch of other films. Like, I finally got to watch Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and that film is a goddamn masterpiece. Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah, follow us on Twitter at Awards Don't Pod to have more such discussions.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, no, I mean, I think you bring up a good point, and I was just thinking that if Gone with the Wind didn't win, I probably wouldn't have sat through it as just the nominee.
Do you think that if it didn't win Best Picture, that it would still be loved? Because Wizard of Oz, it doesn't.
No, fuck no. It wouldn't. I can guarantee you it wouldn't. This is a movie that people, especially modern folks now, like there's no, why would you watch a 4-hour movie about the Civil War from the perspective of Southern rich white people if there wasn't something attached to it? Right. So either it had to win the Oscar or it had to be one of those that's like, it had to be like Wizard of Oz is now, where it's like, this is what should have won. What a picture, blah, blah, blah. Or if it just made the amount of money it did and didn't win, then probably still it'd be one of those movies like, oh, it's, you know, if you take out inflation, it's the movie that's made the most money ever. So there must be something there. So it probably would still have its fans just, but if it was a movie that like, you know, just broke even or made a little bit of money and then didn't win awards, no, not on its own merits. I don't think so. Like, unless you really love Clark Gable, like I do, then maybe you would watch it. But other than that, nah, I don't think so.
I mean, I probably would watch it just for Clark Gable, yeah. Like, it's
a good-looking man.
He's a really
good-looking
man.
Sexy.
Yeah, he is. And he captures the screen so well, you know.
Yep, absolutely.
He's no Ashley Wilkes, though.
Oh, shut the fuck up. This is where we end the episode, because I'm going to get violent. Yeah, you should follow us on Twitter, and you can talk to Andrew on his two different accounts. It'll be great.
And sometimes I talk to myself.
Yes,
shut up,
I've noticed that. Yes, absolutely. Shut up, stupid Australian. You're not wanted here. So yeah, it's what is it? Awards
That's
Don't Pod?
One.
Is that the, yep. that the? All right. Yeah, check us out there and tell us why Gone with the Wind is actually good and not
I'm
racist.
I'm genuinely curious.
I fucking dare you. Go ahead, give it your best shot, white people.
Oh, I can never make you understand because you don't know the meaning of fear. You never mind facing realities. You never want to escape from them as I do.
Escape? Oh, Ashley, you're wrong. I do want to escape, too. I'm so very tired of it all. I've struggled for food and for money. I've weeded and hoed and picked cotton till I can't stand it another minute. I tell you, Ashley, this earth is dead. It's dead. The Yankees and the coffee-baggers have got it, and there's nothing left for us. Run away.
We go to Mexico. They want officers in the Mexican army. We could be so happy there. Ashley, I'd work for you. I'd do anything for you. You know you don't love Melanie. You told me you loved me that day at 12 Oaks. And anyway, Melanie can't... Dr. Mead told me she couldn't ever have any more children than I could give you.
Can't we ever forget that day at 12 Oaks?
Do you think I could ever forget it? Have you forgotten it? Can you honestly say you don't love me?
No, I don't love you.
It's a lie.
Well, even if it is a lie, do you think I'd go off and leave Melanie and the baby? Break Melanie's heart? Scarlett, you mad? You couldn't leave your father and the girls.
I couldn't leave them. I'm sick of them. I'm tired of them.
Yes, you're sick and tired. That's why you're talking this way. You've carried the load for all of us. But from now on, I'm going to be more help to you, I promise.
There's only one way you can help me. Take me away. There's nothing to keep us here.
Nothing. Nothing except honor. Please, dear, you mustn't cry. You mustn't. Please, my brave dear, you mustn't.
You do love me, you do love me.
No, don't.
You love me, you love me.
We won't do this, I tell you, we won't do it. It won't happen again. I'm going to take Melanie and the baby and go.
Say it. You love me.
All right, I'll say it. I love your courage and your stubbornness. I love them so much that a moment ago I could have forgotten the best wife a man ever had. But Scarlett, I'm not going to forget her.
There's nothing left for me. Nothing to fight for. Nothing to live for.
Yes, there is something. Something you love better than me, though you may not know it. Tara.
Yes, I still have this. Go. I won't have you all starve simply because I threw myself at your head. It won't happen again.